Okay. Today's date is May the 5th, 2009, and my name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm with the Reverend Elzine Strong, and we are at the History Center in Diboll, and we're going to do an oral history today, and we have a couple guests present, if they wouldn't mind speaking their names so we would know who they are if they speak on the tape.
I'm Deborah Buster, Reverend Elzine Strong's niece.
Okay.
Betty Murphy.
Okay. All right. Okay, Reverend Strong, if you wouldn't mind, we'll start off by asking you when and where you were born.
I was born in Chilbert County, about 20 miles east of Center, on what we call the Huxley Bay now. I raised corn and cotton on that before the lake was there. And I was born in 1925. I am one of nine children, a great mother and dad, V.C. Strong and Fleeter Strong. And
where did they grow up, your parents?
They grew up in that area, too.
Okay. What was your mother's maiden name?
Fleming. Fleeter Fleming. And I finished high school at Huxley. I'll say at Huxley, we finished grade school at Huxley, high school at Shelbyville.
Okay.
And
what year did you graduate? Did you graduate high school?
Yes, sir. Okay. 1943.
Okay.
And I have you want to go ahead with some education now or not?
Well, let's see. You mentioned that you farmed. Is that what your tell
yes,
us
sir.
A little bit about your father and what
okay.
did he do for a living?
My dad was a carpenter. He's a blacksmith man, and he was a foreman on a road with CC Company way back then and during the Depression.
The Civilian Conservation Corps?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
One of the local camps there?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
They came in, dug me in the Army. I was only 13. Daddy put my age down as 18. And so they come in, dug me, and we all had a cry. And then they decided he had an age down, so they withdrew that, so I didn't have to go.
Now, you said you were one of nine children. Where about were you in the order there, age-wise?
I am fourth.
Fourth, okay. So
I'm a twin.
So by the time the Depression hit, you were, say, what, five, six, 7 years old?
About seven.
Okay.
About seven.
So you had some older brothers and sisters?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So talk a little bit about the Depression. You mentioned your father worked for the CCCs. Can you?
Okay, the Depression days were sad days. I remember one time my dad would borrow money from the bank, like $300, to take the family through an entire year to buy feed and clothes, food, and what have you. And one time a big old 18-wheeler backed up to our lot. And I said, Daddy, what's that big old truck out there for? He said, they've come to get our horses and mule and hogs and chickens. So what do you mean, Daddy? He said, well, I borrowed money from them, son, and said I couldn't pay it back, so I asked them to come. I said, you mean you asked him to come get your stuff? He said, yeah. I said, Daddy, that's what we make a living with. You going to let us all starve to death in a pile? He said, no, son. So you'll understand later. He said, I'm trying to make a name for you. I said, a name for me? I won't need a name after I'm dead. And anyway, they got those. And I said, okay, Daddy, I guess this settles our bill hunting. No. said it'll just pay whatever they get for the animals, and that'll pay on it. If we don't, if we lack more, we'll have to pay that later. I said, Daddy. He said, son, you don't understand. I said, I sure don't, Dad. I sure don't. Well, probably 30 years later, I did understand. I went to the bank, and I was in Baptistic work by that time, and I had an old 48 Studebaker car. The notes were $25 a month. I couldn't pay it that month, so I went to the banker, and I said, sir, I want to come in and tell you that I'm sorry, but I'm going to be able to make my car payment this time. He said, are you worried about it? I said, yes, sir. He said, quit. What do you mean, quit? It's my debt, and I'm worried about it. I want to pay it. He said, are you worried about it? I said, yes, sir. He said, stop it. I said, what do you mean? He said, son, I'm not worried about your debt. He said, if you don't pay it, your old daddy will. I remember back when Daddy said, I'm making a name for you. And so on and on, I remember Daddy going to relief and coming in with what we call a tow sack. It's a croaker sack, a big 100-pound. It bought 100-pound of corn, shelled corn, in that sack for the animals. So he had a sack full of clothes from relief. He poured them out there on the floor. So us kids piled around to get what clothes we could find to fit us, and there was none in there small enough for me. But there was one pair that I could kind of tie a little bit around the waist. It was about that too long, so I rolled them up quite a few rolls, and so that was my breeches. Hmm. We made clothes, underclothes, and shirts out of feed sacks.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, they had printed feed sacks, mm-hmm. and if you buy two sacks at a time, which we could sell them for two, but you get enough cloth to make several garments. So the Depression time was very hard. We went to church one time. We went all time to church, and when it was gone, some of the boys in the community came and stole all of our chickens.
While you were at church?
I was at church. When we came in, all of our chickens gone. So we checked later on. We couldn't find very much. And mother had a cousin that worked in the sheriff's department. She told him about it. So they came down and checked around and went down below the house in the woods and found some car tracks. So they went back to the store and matched those car tracks to some tires that had been bought there at Western Auto at the store. They chased this down to these boys. In the meantime, the ice man by the name of Tracy Lovett, he rode ice two times a day down on a big truck, and we'd buy ice and put it back in the chimney. We didn't have an ice box, put it back in the chimney and cover it up with a quilt. And so mother went out to get ice that day, and she said, Tracy, where'd you get that hen? He said, well, I got it from some of the boys. They traded something. She said, that's my hen right there. She laid an egg on my bed every day of the world. Said, that's my hen. Said, I want her back. He pulled her out and gave it to her. So we found the boys, and so the boy, one of them came to church one night and finished, and he paid his part of it. And another one came one night. We were sleeping out on the porch on a mosquito bar. Mosquitoes are bad, and we didn't have any air conditioning. And so this boy came riding up on his horse, called Daddy out, and paid him his part. So that settled it.
Uncle Dan, you were talking about your clothes. Tell him about how you wired your shoes together in the cardboard soles.
We did. We wired the soles of the shoes to the top with copper wire. Of course, I was not the only one. There are just different ones like that. Some didn't even have any shoes, and sometimes I didn't have. But it was hard times. It was depression. Very, very hard times.
Did you go to school regularly all
yes,
through
sir.
The time?
Yes, sir.
And all your brothers and sisters as well?
Now, my oldest sister, she did not get to graduate because our family took illness and she had to drop out of school to take care of us. So Irene, the oldest one, she had to drop out of school, never did get a high school education, but she was real smart. She studied hard at home. And we'd come in from school and knock cotton stalks and corn stalks with a stick, you know, knock them down so you could plow and build another, make another crop. And so it was a pretty rough time. I had a hard time growing up, but we had hogs. I remember the last hogs. Am I going too long?
No.
We had hogs. OIC hogs, big white hogs. They run in the woods behind the house on acorns. And came Christmas time, and my uncle said, "Elzine, you better go in the woods today," he said, "so-and-so's in for Christmas," and said, "Do you know what that means?" I said, "Yes, sir, I'll be there." So I got on my horse and got my dog, and let me tell you about my dog. He's a self-trained dog, half bird, half cur. Self-trained. We lived in the woods. The squirrels would eat their corn and would feed them around and on the edge of the cornfield. My dog would go down and tree the squirrels. I'd go down and kill them. And the last squirrel I killed from that dog, he had his, we had rail fences like this. His front paws on this one, back paws on this one, treed. I said, "Now, Red, you've never lied to me, but this time you have. You just got a mistake somewhere. That squirrel went up that tree, but he's not there. He just kept standing there barking and standing on that fence." I walked around that tree, and the squirrel was up the tree on the other side. That dog didn't trail squirrel. He winded him. He kept his nose up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'd see a squirrel, and he'd leave the trail and go follow it, you know, where it'd go through the trees. When it would stop in that tree, he'd bark.
He's a good hog dog as well?
Good hog dog. Let me tell you about that. Fantastic hog dog. I'd go in the woods and tie my horse, and my dog would bay the hogs and have a bunch of pigs, you know. Well, I'd mark the pigs, and so I'd get off my horse, and I'd say, "Get me a pig," and he'd run the other bunch, you know, and the pigs go everywhere, and he'd get one out here, and he'd run and root it over with his nose and put his paw and his nose on it and hold it till I got there. I'd say, "Okay, turn it loose." He'd turn it loose, he'd go back and bark and keep the old sow and the other pigs around in a huddle. And I'd turn this pig loose, and I'd say, "Get me another one." And he'd flush him again. I don't ever remember him getting the same pig twice, because he saw that blood. He wouldn't get that pig no more. But he rooted on. Now, when the pigs got larger, when I was going to mark them, he would have to catch them by the ear and hold them. But he'd do the same thing with them. He'd hold them one way or another. If they're too big to hold with his paw and his mouth and his, with his nose, he'd just have to catch them with the ear and hold them. But he'd hold them. He's one fantastic dog. And an old gentleman there in the community killed that dog. He was following one of his gyps. There's about 8 dogs following that one. And mine got killed. And I missed my dog. I rode the countryside around and looking for my dog and stopped by this old man's house. I said, "Have you seen him?" "No, son, I hadn't." "I sure hadn't." But said, "If I see him, I'll tell you about him." Well, I went on. My grandma said, "Son, I'll show you your dog in about 3 days." "What do you mean, Ma?" She said, "I'll show you in about 3 days. The buzzard's going to show him to you. He's right over there in that Escopa woods." And sure enough, I saw the buzzards over there. Mom said, there's your dog." I said, "Come on, Daddy, we're going to go." "No, no, no, son. No, son. No, son. We can't do that." I said, "That old man didn't kill your dog. And I said, well, Daddy, at least you can set this boy's mind at ease. I need to know something. Come on with me and go over there and let's look and see. I begged and begged and finally said, okay, but you're not going to find your dog. We got over and found my dog. He'd been knocked in the head, had a rope tied to his head. They drug him over there and the buzzards got him. I said, when I get old enough, I'm gonna whip that old man. When I got old enough, by that time I'd prayed through to the Holy Ghost and I had to forgive him. Instead of whipping him, I forgave him.
Well, let's jump to the education.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, you left out what your dad did as a minister. Your dad being a preacher?
Do it now.
Your dad being a preacher.
Yeah, Dad was a lay preacher. He never was a full-time pastor. He did have license to preach. Our community was a small community. We had a small church. And
was it multi-denominational or church?
We was Pentecostal.
Okay.
Oneness Pentecostal. And
but no other congregations shared the church building?
No, sir. Okay. Now, there was another church building there in the community. It was Baptists and Methodists that shared that one. But ours was one little building all of its own. It was ours. My grandpa gave us that building.
And what was his name?
William Penn Fleming.
Okay.
And so we had that church, and there'd be a pastor sometime. He'd pastor three or four churches. He may come there and preach once a month, but he's the pastor. Then somehow we wouldn't have a pastor. Well, my daddy would preach, and daddy would walk 10 miles to preach at another church down the way that didn't have a pastor. He'd walk 10 miles down there sometime to preach. But he was not a real full-time pastor, but Dad was a real, real Christian, loved God. And it's through him that the big church in Center now was organized. It was a small frame church, too, across the tracks. And my daddy was a member there, and he got some of the men together and said, let's get this church into organization. Said that we'll build another church and have a nice church for the community. And so they worked with him, and they did. They built a big church there and had several pastors, Brother B.H. McCoy, Brother Harris is there right now. But it's a nice church. But my daddy's at the foot of it. And so he loved the Lord. One night we was coming from church, and I was following along with him, and he had the lantern. We looked over there, and there's a man laying in a ditch. Go over and looked, as my uncle. He had his head on a round gallon jug of whiskey for a pillow. Flies going in and out of his mouth, and oh mercy, that made an impression on me. As I got older, my uncle was a fantastic man. He loved me, and he loved my family. Of course, my mother was his sister. Daddy couldn't find work all the time, and so my uncle gave me work. He's working for the government as a surveyor, and I was his chainman. He gave me work, and me and him would buy a few old scrawny cows and sell them, make a few dollars out of them. So he helped me get a little start of cattle. He helped me buy my first horse. And I thought
this
he was...
This is your uncle?
He was my uncle.
And what's his name again? Or did we say?
J.E. Fleming.
J.E. Fleming.
They called him Sweetie Fleming.
And what does J.E. stand for?
Jesse Everett.
Jesse Everett.
Okay. And so he's a good man, but he drank all the time. So he'd help me to drive him around. He had a pickup. I didn't at the time, so he'd help me to drive him around here and there to for these cattle and what have you, and we'd buy them, and he'd help me drive them to the auction sale and sell his cattle. And he'd say, come on, son, drink some of this stuff. It'd make you feel like $1 million. I said, "Yeah, Uncle Edward, I see it does. I can tell when you take a drink, you..." I said, "I can tell it just makes you feel like $1 million. He said, "Yes, son, that's right." I said, "This stuff will make a fool out of you." I said, "Don't never drink this junk." I said, "I won't," because I remember him in that ditch, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had a cousin that was my same age. He'd go with us sometime, and then sometime he'd drive him. Well, he took him up where he drank, and today he's dead in the grave from cancer, from whiskey and drugs. Mm-hmm. I never used drugs. My mother and dad were bona fide Christians. They prayed all the time. I like to die at one time when I was 9 years old, and they had the clothes to lay me out in. And they kept on, before I got to that serious, they wanted mother and dad to let them take me to the doctor. They didn't have any money. And they said, "I will pay the bill." I said, "No, no, God's going to heal him." So they kept working around outside in the peach orchard, praying. And I was in and out of consciousness for about 3 months, and they had my clothes lay me out in long handle underwear. Of course, back then they laid you out on a cooling board in the house. Well, the Lord raised me up, and here I am today, big as Ike.
Before you go to education, tell him how you came about the Holy Ghost and your baptism.
Okay. Well, when I was a little bitty child, they baptized me. They had to break the ice to baptize me. Never did get sick. Never did get sick at all. And then when I was 19 years old, we drove 20 miles on the back end of a pickup to a tent revival in Center. And I got the Holy Ghost there, and I felt like I needed to be rebaptized. So I was rebaptized, got wet again, and but I didn't get sick then either. After driving home and that wet, my wet clothes, didn't get sick again either. So a little while after that, I was in the church there at Center.
So this is after you graduated from high school?
Yes, sir. No, sir, that's before.
I was thinking you were a little younger than 19.
I was younger than... Yeah, that was before I graduated from high school.
Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking it was...
And,
he was in his teens.
Early 40s, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, I got the Holy Ghost that night. It was just a church gathering. I had graduated because I come from Orange. I was working down there in the bag factory. And I came from Orange up to my mom and dad's, and so I went to the church that night, no revival, just regular service on Saturday night, about 12 people there. And I had promised God before that time that as every time I had a chance, I was going to the altar. Well, that night, the preacher just preached to the saints, and he said, "Well, if anybody here wants to come pray, you can." The devil said, "That's not an altar call." I said, "It's too close to an altar call." I said, "I promised God, and I'm going. I may not pray long, but I'm going." And he tried to talk me out, and I went on. I got down to the altar, and I started praying a little bit, and the longer I prayed, the better I felt. I got the Holy Ghost that night. I mean, there was no air conditioning. I sweated everywhere. I sloshed sweat in my shoe. But I got the Holy Ghost that night, and I talked in tongues, and the preacher said, "We may as well go home. He may talk in tongues till daylight." And I heard what he said, but, you know, I just thought to myself, "If you must, you may. Go home. I feel good right where I am." that was my religious start.
Okay. Yeah, I guess in the context of all that, if we can go back to that question about some of your formal education. And
okay, my education.
After high school. And
I finished grade school at Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a had a teacher, Mr. Chester Holt. He didn't have any fingers at all. There's all like this. He didn't have fingers at all. He was a marksman. He was a real sharpshooter. He shot a pistol, a 22 Manly, and he shot a shotgun. He's a bird hunter. He's my school teacher. He'd keep me and my first cousin and two of the other kids out of his class, and we'd sing at recess. He'd take us off to his church and other places to sing quartet for him. That was in high school. He made chairs and put them in a bottle. Did you ever see one of them?
The little bitty, like a little knick-knack?
Yeah, build a ship in a chair.
Yeah, a ship in a bottle kind of thing.
I got one. I got the last one he made.
Or a little penny in a small bottle or something?
It's a chair in a whiskey bottle. He let us see him at school. He let us see him do everything, and I helped him put the post in there and weave the bottom. But when it come time for the stopper, he made the stopper and had a crossbar inside on that stopper. He wouldn't let us see him do that, but we could watch him do the other. And so he's my favorite school teacher. Very, very good. I could tell you some woolly stories about Scoob.
Well, that might be something to follow up on, but if you can, let's bring it up a little bit more to present day.
Okay.
And then we'll get to Die Ball.
Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. I finished a school, a grade school at Huxley. I finished high school at Shelbyville, and
and you lived at home all the while, right?
Yes,
with
sir.
Your mom and dad. Okay.
Yes, sir. We drove 30 miles one way back and forth to high school, to Shelbyville, mm-hmm. from Huxley.
Okay.
Later, we moved to Center. Then, from there, I have my education. I'll continue that. I have a THB at Texas Bible College. And I have an associate's degree from Angelina College.
What is THB?
That's a degree in theology.
Okay.
Bachelor of Theology.
Okay. Oh, okay. T small h.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a 4-year course in that, and I have a 2-year course in Angelina College, with an associate's degree there.
And where was your bachelor's in theology?
In Houston, Texas.
Houston, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was the did it have the name of the school or
Texas Bible College?
Texas Bible College in Houston.
It's now down.
It's now here at the campground.
Okay, yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
I hope to, anyways.
Okay.
But and then you went to Angelina College, you said?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now that would have been much later, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. I went there and. And Mr. Wilton Killam, you may know him.
Yes, sir.
He was my sociology teacher. And I teased him later on. I said, man, this is a great college. I said, I came in and it took me exactly 20 years to get a degree.
Exactly.
He said, man, this is a great college. He sniggered and laughed. He said, now, Brother Strong said, go back and tell me a little bit about that. I said, well, you see, when I first came to Die Ball, when this college opened up, the first day it opened up, I came here. I took a Bible course. Then I took some courses in speech, English, sociology, and history, and what have you, that I thought would help me with my ministry. And I said I had to drop out. In the meantime, I went to Texas Bible College, and I got a THB down there, and I came back then to Angelina College and asked him. I said, "Can you give me some credits on my credits in THB?" He said, "To bring your transcript up." At that time, I was renting their college dorms in the summertime for a camp meeting there at Lufkin. I'm making them money. So he kind of liked me because I'm making the money for the college, you know. So he said, bring them up. He looked at him. He went to the board and he said, I know we don't normally do this, but said, let's do it for him.
Of course, the Angelina College, I guess, was 68, right, when it opened?
62.
But before, if we could, let's back up. You came to Dybal in 1954, is
right.
That correct? Okay. What, you already had your bachelor's in theology before then?
Well, before I went to Angelina College, I did.
But not before you came to Dybal?
No, sir.
Okay.
No,
well,
sir.
Just before you came to Dybal, what were you doing, and how did you come to Dybal?
Okay, before I came to Dybal, I was pastoring a church in Tallulah, Louisiana. I had evangelized for 6 years.
What town?
Tallulah, Louisiana.
Okay.
Tell him about Oklahoma. Start with Oklahoma.
We preached revival for a year. Revivals in Oklahoma. And
now you said we.
Me and my wife.
Okay.
Now, we started off, me and my brother-in-law, he was my friend at that time. We finally married my sister. We evangelized for a year. I evangelized for a year by myself. Me and my wife evangelized then for 3 years. And so we was in Oklahoma. I was preaching in Iris, Louisiana.
When did you get married?
In 1948.
48, okay. And what was your wife's name?
Doris Strong.
Strong, okay.
Doris Forbes Strong.
Where did you meet her?
Orange, Texas. I was working down there in the shipyard and a bag factory.
During the war? During World War II.
And okay. Her and her family had moved down there. And
tell us a little bit about Orange during World War II. It jumped five times larger than it was before.
Yes, sir.
Population-wise.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell a little bit about what did you do? Worked in the shipyard?
Yes, sir. I worked at two shipyards. Worked at one shipyard as a ventilator man. Worked at another shipyard as a ship fitter helper. Then I worked at a paper mill there in Orange and I got my hand in a bag mill and I had to lay off from work about 6 weeks. So while I was off, I preached revival and out from center there. But when I went back to work, I worked there for a while. Then I began to feel my call to preach. So I went to my superintendent and told him that I was going to quit. I was going to start evangelizing. He said, you got a good job here. Said, you're going to get out there and you're not going to make a living. I said, well, I will. I'll make some of a living, but I said, my benefits will be eternal. He said, are you not sure it'd be infernal? And I said, well, I don't know, but I just feel a call of God, so I'm going to make the leap. So I left, went on the evangelistic field. My first new car I ever bought was a 1950 model Ford. I paid $1,900 for it.
Where were you living then? Was that in Oklahoma?
No, in Orange then.
Still in Orange in 50.
In Orange.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, then we started, I saw my wife and I thought she was about 13 years old. I thought she's a pretty 13-year-old, but she's pretty. But I, you know, she's too young for me. And so later on, I learned she's a little older. So I kind of got a little closer to her, you know. And so we started eyeing each other and finally wound up marrying. I tell them jokingly sometimes that she finally talked me into marrying her.
So you did evangelistic work in Oklahoma and
Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, but mainly in Oklahoma. There's a little little unique story about Oklahoma. I was preaching revival in Aris, Louisiana, and a man from Oklahoma came on, and he's preaching revival at another place there. Well, on that off night, he came to visit our revival. And he came, and he asked church, he said, Brother Strong, do you want to go to Oklahoma and preach? I said, well, yeah, I'd like to get out of Texas, my home state, for a little bit. But I said, I don't know nobody in Oklahoma. He said, well, I do. I said, but you don't even know me. He said, yes, I do know you. He said, I've been investigating you. He said, I've been asking about you. He said, if you want to go to Oklahoma, I'll send you to Oklahoma, and you stay there for a solid year if you want to. I said, well, really? He said, yeah. I said, okay, do it. He made a one call, 500 miles. I got there, and the pastor, I preached one night. The pastor got up the next morning and said, Brother Strong, you're gonna pastor the church here for 3 weeks. I'm leaving to get married. And said, you're going to live in my house here. I've got a cup here in a cabinet with $50 in it. That's for little change and things you might need. I've got your open grocery account here at the store close by. You're going to get any kind of groceries you want. Said, I'll be back in 3 weeks. My Lord, I thought. But we did. We preached revival, had a good revival, baptized people, and we left. And he told me before he left, he says, now, I'll be coming back a certain time, and said, you'll leave before I get here for your next revival. And so sure enough, I did leave for the next revival to go preach for the district superintendent up there. And so we left, and he came in. And so I stayed a year in Oklahoma preaching. Now, I got plenty to say. You just asked me what you...
Well, I'd like to get to Dieball if we could. Were you in Oklahoma immediately prior or Louisiana?
No, Louisiana. Tell him about the church you built in Louisiana.
At where?
Tell him about the church you built in Louisiana.
Yeah. I went to Little Louisiana. I preached revival there, and there's just a handful of people. But they fell in love with me, and I felt sorry for them. And so they didn't have a pastor, and they begged me to come pastor them. And I said, I'll come, and we'll build a church. But it won't be a long term. I'll just come because I feel sorry for you, and I believe I can. And I was about 28 years old. So we built a church there, and
tell him where you started in the barn.
Do what now?
The barn church where y'all started in the barn.
Okay. We first started there before we built the church in a hay barn out in the country, and it was quite a deal. I played the accordion. We went there, and one night I saw the front door some boys outside catching bugs and poking them through that window. Well, they're flying all around them, and people are scared of the bugs, you know. So I eased out the side door and went around there and caught them on the front porch. Anyway, I went back, and they didn't give me no more trouble. But later on, I was going to build a church there, and some of the old city dads said, there'll never be a Pentecostal church in this town. Never, never, never. Well, I had a plumber in my church that was working for this man in the city, and I knew he had some lots in the city. So I went and called on the house and talked to my plumber, and we got friends, and I'd go sit on the front porch with these old people, and he'd ice cream with them, you know, and made friends with them. And I said, Mitch Hicker, don't you have some property here? He said, yeah, I got some lots here. Would you sell me a couple of lots for church? He said, sure will. And I said, now I've got everything ready. I said, how quick can you do it? He said, tomorrow. I said, let's go, let's do it tomorrow. Well, when we got the deed signed, some of the old city slickers came and and said, Mr. Shicker, we don't want that man here in town. He's Pentecostal. We don't want him here in town. He said, listen, that's a good man, and said, this community needs a church, and said, that's my land. He's got a deed to it. He paid the down payment on it, and said, he can build one there. We started building. We had to start from ground up. I had to get a cement mixer, and we men gathered together and mixed the concrete, and we was working on the sewer for the bathroom. Well, the neighbors that lived right next to it there, well, they were boogers, and our cement mixer was making havoc with his TV. So it made them mad. I didn't know about it at the time, but they made it up between themselves, him and another man or two around there, and said, we're going to go there and mop that world up with that little guy. So they came over. When they got over there, I had a couple of my men down in that hole, you know, working. They had big, robust men. They looked down that hole and saw them, and they turned and walked away. So we built that church. I was on the roof one morning, frosty morning, and I had a big, long, tall black man working with me. We'd sawed some of the end roofing off, you know. We didn't trim it off real smooth. At first, we just let them go wild until we got through. Well, that morning, I got up on the cone of that church, and I started sliding down. And I thought, my God, down to the end of this place is all kind of nails and boards. If I fall down there, that'd kill me, sure. So I reached out and my leg and stopped myself with one of those boards. And I reached my hand way back up, and this black man caught my hand. You're talking about an angel's hand. When that black man pulled me back up, you know. I said, well, let's get down from here till this frost gets over. So we built that church. I stayed there for a year and a half, got the church going real good. And it's burned now. That one burned, but they bought another one. It's going good, real, real well. Then I came to Dieball.
What brought you to Dieball?
Pardon?
What brought you to Dieball?
Okay, I pushed revival here for Brother O.R. Foss in Dieball in 1951.
What was that last name?
Foss.
Foss.
Okay.
Everybody knows him around here. He was he's a speed demon and a hunter and a fisher, outlaw hunter and a fisherman.
His family was great.
Go ahead.
I won't tell all this, because if he's still alive, if he were to read this, he wouldn't like it. But
you had preached a revival in 51.
Right. And there's an elderly lady here that was in that revival. There's a man here in the church that was going on vacation. And she told him, said, I want you to go by and see if Brother Strong will come be our pastor. He said, well, I'll go by and see him. He said, I'm going to go through there, through anyway. So he came by and called me out to the curb, and he started talking to me and tried to make a financial bargain with me to be the pastor. I said, no, I won't work under those situations.
That was DeWitt Wilkerson.
Huh?
That was DeWitt.
Yeah, but I don't want that in the,
I'm sorry.
In the nose. And so we talked, and he still tried to dicker with me, and I said, no, I won't work on that condition. He said, well, you know, all I got to do is go back and say nothing, you won't go. I said, that's okay with me. I said, I don't know where I'm going. I'm not going to be here much longer, but I'm going somewhere, but I don't have to go to Dieball. It doesn't matter to me. God's got a place for me somewhere. So he went back. Sure enough, later on, I got a card, postcard from him. And, it just worked out till I come and talk to the church board. Well, at that time, the church changed pastors about every year and a half. And so when I came, I learned that, and I told the church board, I said, now I won't work under these circumstances. I said, now you can vote on me in 6 months if it's necessary, but you're not going to set a certain time. Every time I have a business meeting to elect our church officers, you're not going to vote on me. I'm going to have that. They said, we don't want that. Well, he's sitting there. And so he didn't say nothing. So they elected me as pastor here. And about a year and a half after, he came to me and said, we're going to, in our business meeting this year, we're going to have an election on you. I said, no, you're not. Yes, we are. No, you're not. Yes, we are. No, you're not. What you going to do about it? I said, give me a few days and I'll get back with you. He later on, he said, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to have a church business meeting before we have the annual church officers meeting. And I'm going to tell the church that has come to me that the church is going to practice an annual pastoral election and that they want to vote on me this year. And I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. If the church decides they're going to do that, I'm resigning that night. You won't vote on me. I'm resigning that night. But if they say they don't want to have a church election every year, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do so you can start working on it. If you can block it, okay. I'm going to have the church to pass a resolution in their business meeting that they put in the minutes that this church will not practice an annual pastoral election. After it was over, he said that was as smooth as it could be. That was done fair. Okay. 3 weeks later, he said that was as crooked as a barrel of snakes. Well, I had trouble with him all the time. About every 3 months, he'd call me up. I was making too much money. I got a blackboard in the back of a Sunday school room. And I asked him, I said, how many hours do you work a week? He said, it's none of your business. I said, how much do you make an hour? He said, it's none of your business. I said, okay, I'll put up here about how many hours you work, I know. And I know about how much you make per hour, and I'll put up here, and we'll see. So I finished, and I put up there how many hours I worked. Me and my wife worked close to 70 hours every week. She did, and I did. And I put up there my salary compared to his. He looked at it, and he said, you're not going to tell this on me, are you? And so I said, now, I want to tell you now, this is the last time I'm going through this with you. I said, now, if there's anything else comes up, your crawl gets full. You come to me anytime, 2 times a week if you want to, but not on this subject, not on money. I've showed you that I'm not making too much money. I'm not making near as much as you do. I'm not making enough money. But you're such a tightwad, you think anything I make's too much. But I said, it's not too much. Now, I don't want this coming up no more. And I said, you can bring anything else up to me you want to, and I'll talk with you about it, but not this. So he never bothered with me anymore. So,
where was the church located when you came? And let's talk a little bit about.
It was located right across from the high school.
Just right over here, huh?
Where the temple building stands.
Yeah.
Okay. And in a little pine grove, beautiful, beautiful place.
About how many members of the church did you have, and say regular attendance
back then?
Yeah, in the beginning when you first came.
Probably 115.
Okay, is that members or regular attendance?
Sunday school members.
Okay,
and we built it up. We had as high as 100, as high as 230 something.
About what year was that?
Pardon?
Now, you said you built it up to.
Yeah,
about
that
doubled it. What year?
That was about. Yeah, about 1960.
Okay.
Close to there. And when I first came here, the church had toilets outside, men's and women's toilets outside. No air conditioning at all. They had the educational building was under new construction, and so when we first came, I finished that construction, paid it off. We made a loan And I borrowed a ditch digging machine from the company, and I got on that ditch digging machine and dug a ditch for the sewer line and the water line, and we installed restrooms in the church and put running water in, city water, city sewer, and finished that construction work there. And then we've just been progressing since then. In
1964.
I moved in 65. 64, Clyde Thompson. Did you know him?
Not personally. No.
He was vice president of the company. And, well, he, Arthur Temple had him to come down and talk to me. They wanted the land there where we were. I said, "Mr. Thompson, don't you park your car there in my driveway no more." I said, "If you want to talk to me, you call me and I'll meet you in Lufkin somewhere and we'll talk." "Why?" I said, "I know what you want." I said, "When they see your car, they know your car, they know you. And they gonna know what you want." And I said, it's gonna freeze things. I said, "Now if you work with me, I'll work with you. I want to move the church, but the church, I know the sentiments of a church. They don't want to move the church at all. I want to move it. The sewer line running around in front of it. Had to go to the Gulf Station, go around and come to the back of the church, come in. Had to go down to OK Food, come around to the back. We had a bridge across the front there and the sewer line running right under it." I said, "I'd like to move away from here, but I know the church been here all their life, and I'm not going to try to move them without some incentive to move them. I've got to dangle something in front of them that they'll want to move instead of me trying to make them move." I said, "Don't you park your car here anymore." So he didn't. We met several times in Lufkin and talked. And I said, "Now, Mr. Thompson, that's good property." And I said, "I've got to have something to help the people that want to move." And he said, "Well, we can work something out." I said, "Okay, when we move, I want to build another church. I need a bigger church. And I want to build a brick church, nice church." And he said, "Well, I can understand that." I said, "Well, the company can help me do it." I said, they can let me buy material at cost and get me some more property." He said, "Well, we'll be glad to do that." So that worked out. Mr. Temple himself came down and got me in his Cadillac. We started around here and then started out of city limits. I said, wait a minute, I'm not going out of city limits. I said, "I'm in the city limits here and I don't want to out of the city limits." He said, okay. He whipped the car around and said, "Now..."
Of course, the city had just incorporated just prior to that.
Right.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. He said, "Brother Strong, if there's a building on the property you like," I said, "don't worry about that. We'll just pick it up and move it." So we're coming down Highway 59. I said, there it is right there." He said, "My God, Brother Strong, that's expensive property." I said, "It's not too expensive for God." I said, "That's the property I want right there." He said, okay, we'll do it. So he made me deed to the property and is going to start moving it, moving the church. Well, when we started to move the church, the builder said, "We can't move that church one moving like we thought we could. We're going to have to cut it in two." It had a big T on it, you know, the education building. And it said it's going to cost $1,500 more to build it, to move it. So I went to Mr. Temple, and I said, "Mr. Temple, now I made the deal with you and I'll stick with it. But I said, if you could, you could help me with this because it's going to cost $1,500 more to move the church than me and you thought at first." He said, "How much is that?" I said, $750, your part. He said, Wilbur, what do you think about that? He was in the next office. He said, whatever you say, Arthur. He said, Betty, write Brother Strong a check for $750. And so we started moving it. When it did, you can put as much of this in there as you want to, or even much out as you want to. Seemed of God raised up and said, we don't want you up here. Said, you're going to build a nice church. And said, we got a small church here. And said, it's very small, and we don't want a big church here to make a dwarf us. And I said, look, what's going to happen is, and you can do it, your church is larger than mine right now. I said, I'm going to build a church, and I said, your man's going to get jealous, and you're going to build a church too. You're going to build a nice church. Well, we won't do it. We're not going to do it. I bickered with the mayor for quite a while. Arthur Temple said, Brother Strong, we're getting ready to move that church. I said, we can't do it, Mr. Temple. Can't do it. Why? Said, the Assembly of God people is raising Ruka. Said, what do we care? I said, you care and I care. I don't care. I said, yes, you do. How will I care? I said, Mr. Temple, you don't want these men, their men, and my men at your company working together over there, and they're mad at one another. Well, I didn't think about it that way. I said, well, that's the way it'll be. But I said, now, if you'll give me time, I'll work at this, and I'll work it peaceably where we can move in here. Our men, your men will work together over there side by side and be friends. Well, we worked at it a while longer, and they still wouldn't budge. Mr. Temple would come back and chomp on his cigar and cuss. Say, what that preacher going to preach about Sunday? I said, I don't know, but I'm sure it'll be something good. And he said, let's move that church. I said, no, sir. No, sir, we're not going to move it. I said, now, look, you've got an acre of land between them and me. Give me that acre of land. I'll split it with them. They don't have a deed to their property. They've only got a 99-year contract. They pay something like a dollar a year for that, but they don't have a clear deed to it. You give me that acre of land, I'll split that acre of land with them, and you give them a clear title to their church, and we'll settle. Brother Strong, I said, Mr. Temple, 1 acre of land is worth nothing to you between the two churches. It's not big enough to build no kind of a plant. You can't build a housing project out of it. And I said, now that'll settle it. Okay, we'll do it. Said, now get to work on it. So I went back to the pastor and I said, Brother Hood, I'll do this, this, and this, and this. And I said, now you'll get a half acre of land right here on the highway, extremely expensive land. You'll get a clear deed to your church that you've never had a clear deed to. If you'll talk to your men and you'll be peaceable and tell them to be peaceable, we'll get along together. Me and you've never had any problems. But I said, now this come up, and I said, there's problems, and I want you to help me. He said, I'll meet with my board. Said, I think we can work it out. So he came back and said, we're going to do it. Before all that happened, Mr. Thompson said, Brother Strong, that's your acre of land. You go ahead and take an acre of land and tell them to kiss your foot, and we're going to move that church in. I said, oh, no, we're not, Mr. Thompson. We're not. I'm going to have peace here at any cost. So we finally worked it out. And so Mr. Temple moved us in there. We started construction on it, and we put it back together, the two buildings, put them back together. We had church in that for a year. We started building on the auditorium in 1966. And we built on that for about a year before we got into it. We men worked on it, and we hired some craftsmen to help us with it, but we men did most of it ourselves. And that's where we are.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the broader community things. You mentioned city limits a while ago. Of course, City of Diboll didn't incorporate until 62 as a city. The late 60s, I guess, when the company started bringing in Hispanic families. Just some of those. And of course, during the 60s, the company started growing and expanding in different avenues, went public in 69. So maybe just talk in the context of that, the community as a whole in the 1960s, someone who...
Okay, Mr. Thompson come to me again and said, Brother Strong, I want you to meet with me and Vern Burkhalter. We're going to get a few of the pastors here in town meet together to form a welcome committee for the Spanish people that's coming here. We did. We met in the old scout house. Now I've never. I can go back through my diary. I've had a diary for about 60 years. But anyway, I don't remember right now what year it was. But we met in the old scout house, and we formed a committee to welcome them in here. And so they came. Before they came, the town. The wage scale here was pretty low, and when my kids graduated from school, they lived and went to Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, places like that, so they have better employment, you know, and they had some families there, so my kids didn't stay here to raise their family, because they moved off where they had better jobs, and they raised their family off from here. So that began to dwindle my church some. When the Hispanics come in, they were clannish, like normal, like I would be. They'd want to go to an English-speaking church. I couldn't speak Spanish. They'd want to go to that church, so they went to another church. And they'd come here and they worked, and they made good employees for the church. And so during the school years, then I preached two of the baccalaureate services here, the graduation exercises. I went to Mr. Wilbur Pate. Do you ever know him?
Know of him.
He's a good man. He's a superintendent here then. I went to him. I said, Mr. Pate, why can't my church have a graduation exercise? He said, Brother Strong, they could. Said, none of the preachers ever wanted one. Said, I didn't think you ought to have them. I said, well, this is a new preacher here. And I said, I want one. And I said, just quick as you can. He called me up later and said, it'll be this year. Said, I got it through. So we're going to have it this year. We had at our church, he and Mr. Ramsey and some of the singers from the school and my choir sang the songs that year. I cannot find my way alone. And I preached the baccalaureate service, and I preached another at the Methodist church. And so, and when I first came to Diboll, the pastors here would go to the school every morning and have morning devotion over the loudspeaker, over the public address system for the school. And so that went on until they finally closed the prayer in the school down. Finally closed it down. And so a lady came to me not very long ago and said, you don't know me, but I know you. Said, I came up as a child in the school. Said, I remember you're praying for us every morning at school. And said, I remember it was always refreshing to me, because it seemed like you loved us all, wanted us to study hard and be good. And said, I remember that very well. So I had a great part in the community service here.
What about a couple of other things that come to mind in the 60s are school integration and the Vietnam War? Just from your perspective as someone who... Not just as a minister, but just as
okay.
a member of the community. Can you
okay.
tell me a little bit what stands out as far as integration?
The integration, it was very slow here, very slow. Mr. Arthur Temple can have much, much credit for that. The colored people were good workers, and... there were a lot of the employees here at the place. And it was pretty rough for a while, but Mr. Temple He's a real community man himself, and he worked with all people. He'd have meetings, and he'd talk to them about trying to get along one with another and about the importance of education, and that we ought to be fair with our fellow man, and so on and so forth. And so he worked it, and it worked well. And so he was able to integrate the school system and work it out real good. And so it's worked real well. We had some men that went to the Vietnam War from this community, not many from my church, but a few from this area. But we all were patriotic, all everybody. We had prayer constantly for the boys, for the soldiers, and it was a part of our church program to pray for them.
You mentioned Mr. Temple, Arthur Temple Jr., of course. I understand you lived near him
for
a while. So yes. How was it being his neighbor?
It was great. Fantastic.
Did he have a lot of loud parties?
He had some.
Of course, but
he was.
Did you see him out and about a good bit around the house?
Yes, sir, but not a whole lot. Now I went and hunted on there on the Bogus Slough deal, which was owned by the company. I went and hunted up there some with Mr. Thompson, who was the vice president, and Mr. Temple, who was mayor here at that time. I hunted with him up there some in Bogus Slough. I enjoyed that.
Deer hunting?
Yes, sir.
Did you duck hunt any? Or?
I didn't duck hunt. I fished and deer hunted. Mr. Temple was a great sportsman, outdoorsman. He's very clever, very good. He built that clubhouse up there. It cost much, much, much money. He furnished the food, bedding, lodging, and have these congressmen come in and stay there and hunt a week at a time. He'd put them up, feed them, and he'd send them with one of his jeeps to their stand. And if they killed anything, he'd go out to the stand with his jeep and bring the deer in and have his men to skin it and pack it up for them to take it back home. And then when a bill come up in Congress, he'd call these guys up.
I wanted to go
back.
Does
that make any sense to you?
Well, yeah, somewhat.
Charlie Wilson, do you know anything about him?
A little bit. It was a public and governmental relations.
He came up in Arthur Temple's pocket.
Arthur Temple was
able to get a lot done for the company through him.
Yeah. Let's talk a couple things. I don't want to spend too much time on one or the other, but I want to get ultimately to the Texas Bible College that we mentioned earlier, the new camp, the big campground there in Lufkin.
Okay.
Let's just go with that for right now.
Okay.
Tell a little bit about that, and again, from the context of, from your perspective, you know, someone who's been in Angelina County for so long.
Okay.
What is the Texas Bible College?
Texas Bible College had its beginning. We bought property in Houston to start Texas Bible College. It was in
the United Pentecostal Church.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. We bought the property there and started a church. And we found a church, a building that was already there, run down quite a bit. We started a college in that, and I carried a chart around over the entire Texas district. Me and two more men, we carried charts around from church to church, raising funds for Texas Bible College. We raise a fund, built Texas Bible College. In the meantime, it grew, the people around it grew up, and it was mainly citizens that were not really upstanding, and the parents in the district and all over Texas. They didn't want their kids to come there because of that. And so we had to do something. So we stole that and bought property here in Lufkin and brought the college here to Lufkin.
From Houston to Lufkin.
From Houston to Lufkin, that's right.
Were there any churches in Lufkin that were instrumental in helping with that?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Can you name some of those? Well,
about all of the churches were instrumental.
Everybody, okay.
In helping.
Any individuals stand out in?
Well, what happened?
Locally?
We built it with free labor from ministers from all over the district. Brother Gidrose, our district superintendent, would set a certain work week here to camp. And he'd have some cooks to come, we'd buy them food, and they'd fix us meals, and us ministers would come and work and build the tabernacle. And so I was close by here, and I was close to Brother Gidrose, and he was a good friend of mine, and so we worked quite a bit together. But quite a few of the men from the Lufkin area here, from my church and their church, came to work on the church, on the tabernacle. And we got plaques there. My name's on the plaques as a presbyter. I was a presbyter here in the area for 20 years, and I was the home mission director for 2 years, sectional secretary for 2 years. On Texas Bible College board for 4 years, presbyter for 20 years, and so I had quite a bit to do with it. I had one of the men that worked in my church was a foreman for the commissioner that worked at it. He's from Zavala. I asked him if he could help us oil our roads there. At that time, there's just dirt and mud, and so we did. We oiled the roads there at the campground. Of course, now they got most of the main roads, got them concreted now. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was dirt and mud, and we oiled them, and that was all like coming to town.
Well, it certainly, I think, in size, has grown a good bit.
Yes, sir.
In recent years. Can you comment a little bit on that?
We have now normally around 5,000 people to come to a camp meeting.
Which generally lasts how long, the camp meeting?
Last week.
A week.
We have 3 youth camps a year. We have an annual men's fellowship a year. We have an annual ladies meeting a year. We have an annual youth convention a year. We have an annual Spanish camp meeting a year. And odd and ends, there, and the camp is used during Hurricane Ike. That was a central location for a lot of people. They stayed there. Right. One of our pastors, Brother Scoggins, was over that department, and he was there day and night almost to take care of the cooking and getting things together and housing people. And so,
is it still a designated shelter area? Pardon? Is it still a designated shelter area in the
yes,
county?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
For disasters?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
If the storm came and they needed a place, it would be a designated place there for them.
Because you mentioned earlier that the church here in Diboll had every year and a half or so review, and You've done quite a few year and a half terms since then.
Yeah.
So
somebody asked me one time, said, "How in the world did you stay there that long?" I said, "A long time to pastor a church." I said, "It's one of two things, or one of three things." I said, "One is the church has never warned me to leave. Number two is God's never told me to leave. Number three is it might be that I was so mean they couldn't run me off." So I don't know which, but I've never had the church to vote against me. I had one time the same man I mentioned to you back yonder that was very, very, very rough. Good man, but he just, you know, he was the voice of authority in his family all of his life. And I knew that I'd have problems with him when I came. But anyway, he's gonna run me off. He said, "It's time you leave and you're going." I said, "I'm here and you're gonna leave here." And I said, "Well, I may, but I'll be at the leaving." And I said, "You're not gonna just run me off just because you and a member or two of your family is against me." I said, "The rest of the church is not." I said, "I'm not running off from trouble. I'm not afraid of trouble. I'm not going into trouble, but I'm not going to run from it either. I feel like I'm here in God's will." But I said, I'll cut your financial strains." I said, "Okay, that's okay. I don't mind working." I said, "My hands have been in dirt many times. I'll work. If I feel like God's here, man, it don't matter to me." And so he said, "We're going to vote on you this year." I said, "No, you're not."
Okay, Dane, tell him a little bit about the people who have come up through your church. The years that you had the baccalaureate ceremonies.
Okay.
Some of those were top honor students from your church.
Right, right. Top honor roll students.
Year after year, students out of his church made valedictorian and Don Grigsby and
they came back and worked, and two of them was Mr. Thompson's office secretary that worked there in the company.
Who's that?
Pardon?
Do you recall the names?
Yes, sir. Billy Merle Howard and Betty Ann Wilkerson.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They worked with Mr. Clyde Thompson in his office, and they had good jobs, and they liked them real, real well. And I had other
Peggy Wilkerson.
Deborah mentioned Don Grigsby.
Don Grigsby. He went on to be a pastor.
He's graduated here and was in my church. I raised him a small child. He's now over the prison ministry. He has he preaches in about 5 different prisons every week. And he's baptized over 10,000 men over the period of time he's been there. It's been probably 5,000 received the Holy Ghost.
What area?
In Huntsville.
Huntsville area.
He is with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, his chaplain.
Okay.
And he pastors in Madisonville Church, a Union Pentecostal Church in Madisonville.
Madisonville.
Mm-hmm. Tell him about how many pastors have come from your church. I think that's remarkable.
Well, Brother Don Greaves became my church. Brother Kelsey Griffin, he is now a world evangelist, evangelizes in all of the United States and goes overseas. In fact, the headquarters has him occupied now for home missions work. When they have a home missions mission over there, a meeting, mm-hmm. they want him to go and preach that conference. He's a ministerial trainer. And
he grew up in Michael's church.
Do it now.
I said he grew up in your church.
Yeah. He's a scriptorian. He taught in Texas Bible College for years down there. He taught in Bible College in Minnesota, and then he's evangelized all over. He pastored a church in up north someplace. I forget which one.
He's
they passed
the son of Burl and Mary Jane Griffin from the Rock House.
Yeah. He's a chip off the parents of the Rock House here in Diboll.
What about in 54 years of some of the church services, any one or two that stand out in your memory? Any weddings?
Yes, sir.
Church services, funerals, anything like that?
Yes, sir. I've conducted many, many, many weddings, many, many, many funerals. We've had fantastic revivals where people prayed through, received the Holy Ghost, baptized in Jesus' name. I was the official baptizer at the camp meeting there for several years, where they'd come and help. We bought a horse trough. So Brother Giddos had me to do the baptizing. I had waiters that I'd get in the water with them and baptize them. Then I'd stand outside sometime and baptize them. So we had a baptismal service up there real often. And we've had a lot of outstanding services here in Diboll. Brother Don Grigsby's preached for us here. Brother Kelsey Griffin's preached for us here. And Brother Mangan's preached for us here. Brother Dehart. Just a lot of our officials here now have preached for us here at Diboll.
Before you leave that, there were a total of 18 children that grew up in that church that went into ministry.
Yeah.
Foreign missions or home missions or pastoring their own churches.
Pastor's wives.
And
yeah.
Pastor's wives. And I think the story about the Ward girls is phenomenal. Tell him a little bit about the Wards.
About what?
The Wards girls. The Ward girls.
Ward girl, yeah.
The Ward girls.
Jill has, she was grew up here in this church. She married a man from Bible college. She was in Bible college. She married a man there. And they have been in missions field now for like 10 years. They pastored in Germany. They pastored in...
Romania.
Yeah. And they're right now in...
Romania
now. They built churches over there and pastored them and started from scratch. And they recently had to have a chip put in them to come to travel.
To come back to the States.
Hmm.
But the Ward girls all married and are in the ministry. And
Nancy graduated from my church, and she's she married a pastor, and they're pastoring now at Canton.
Texas.
And they pastored also before then, but they're doing real good. They got a son that's a preacher, and he's doing good. And
there's Amy.
Amy?
And Doug.
Amy married a man who was a minister. He's not real active right now. He's in the air conditioning business right now. But they're all doing good. All doing good. Betty Ann Wilkerson graduated out of the church here. She married a preacher. They pastored churches, built churches. We've got quite a number of other people here that came out that was preachers' wives and preachers that came out of the church here. They just scattered all over doing work.
One other question. Outside of the ministry, what are your hobbies? Do you have hobbies? What do you enjoy doing? You mentioned hunting and fishing a while ago.
Yes, sir.
What do you enjoy doing?
I deer hunt and fish when I can.
What kind of fishing?
Any kind. I like to catch bass. I like to eat crappie and catfish.
Where do you fish?
Well, right now, since Chance, a lady in my church, she has a membership in Silver Leaf Club. Over at Flint. Well, in fact, she's got a club all over. She got one in Tennessee, Arkansas, Missouri, California. She got a membership at different places, and so she lets us go with her. Her husband's dead. I said, Lorraine, it's dangerous for you to go off. You're just a woman. I said, you better let me and Sister Strong go with you. I said, you need a big man along to protect you.
Now, where is this that you're going? I'm not really familiar with what you're
describing. Okay, it's about 10 miles south of Tyler,
okay.
Flint, Silverleaf.
It's a timeshare club.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so she...
Well, what body? Is it on a body of water?
Yeah.
Lake Palestine.
Lake Palestine, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you always enjoy bass fishing? And what I'm getting at is, were you into fishing when Sam Rayburn was put in?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Tell a little bit about early bass fishing at Sam Rayburn.
Early bass fishing. I'll be glad to.
Sam Rayburn.
I always have a lot of good friends. I kind of pick friends. I pick friends that likes me and likes what I like to do. Brother Rogers is a good friend of mine. He pastored a church in Lufkin. And we would go fishing together on Sam Rayburn. He found a honey hole over there. And me and him went over there and fished quite often. And he told me one time, he said, Brother Strong, now, there's one place, the pond, the hole was not any bigger than this entire building, this whole building here. He said, preachers that I sent here and asked them to keep account of how many they caught, there's been over 500 bass caught in this one hole, but this hole, one honey hole here. And so I fished with him. I went over on
now, where was the honey hole? Do you still fish it?
Can you still fish it?
Do you still fish it?
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, boy.
Well, it's not there anymore. I mean, it's the trees that was there that made the honey hole. Mm-hmm. They're dead and gone. And I suppose all the fish have been caught out. I don't know. I'd been there in years, but it was one more good fishing place.
Now, how many fish would y'all catch? Say a good day.
We'd catch
the
limit.
Which was at that time?
25.
Okay.
Then sometime we'd go home and put them in the freezer to go back and catch 25 more. You was only allowed 25 in your possession out on the lake.
And now it's just 5.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, in a certain size.
Yeah. And we had Rayburn, 14. Has to be over 14.
I went fishing one time out from Crockett, and me and Brother Rogers walked up, and this man said, "Hey, y'all come here." Said, "I'm going to have to leave." Said, "I'll show you a place here that it is a honey hole." And he said, "I'm going to tell you how to do it, too." He said, "You don't throw it out there and let your line drop on the ground." Said, "No, sir. You throw it out there, and as soon as it hits, you start reeling in fast as you can." Said, "The white perch will hit it." We caught over 100 one day, 80 the next day. I went over there one time by myself, and there's two ladies standing there fishing. But they didn't know how, didn't know where. They didn't get out far enough, and they didn't know how to do it. And I stood there, and it hurt me so much, and I didn't know where any other place was. It was good. And I said, "Ladies, if you let me fish right here between you, I'll fish your rig up, and I'll cast out and catch the first fish for you, and we'll all catch fish." I said, "Now, they're out there, but you're not getting them." "No, we're not. We're not. I didn't get any at all." I said, "Well, I'll show you." So they looked at one another, and they thought, "What about this guy?" But finally they said, okay. I said, "Okay, let me get right here between you. Give me your rigs. I'm going to fix it up for you. I'm going to put the first shiner on. I'm going to cast it out there and catch the first fish for you. And I'm going to tell you how to do it. You throw it out there at a certain place. And when you get it out there, you start reeling as quick as you get it out there. Don't let it hit the bottom if you can help it. You reel real fast. You'll catch fish. If you let it hit the bottom, the little old mud cat about like that will get you bait. They're not good to eat. They'll just eat your bait up. But that place is swarming with white perch. It's a big old brick embankment here, so they come up to this to spawn. They can't get over it. So they're in there by the thousands." And so me and Brother Roger go to one day. was over there and I caught a bunch of fish and I started up the bank with them. I had two strings of fish. This black man sitting on the bank said, Sir, white man, said, don't try to come up this bank with them fish. He said, man, you can't do that. Said, it's too hard. You can't do that. Said, put half of them fish back. And I said, I said, you watch them for you. Nobody get them. I'll watch them for you. And I looked at him really good. He said, sure enough, man, sure enough. I tell you the truth. So I did. I put half of them back. Man, when I got up that bank with those fish, you know, you had to go through sand. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'd make a step and lose half of it. I finally got up there and he said, now, let me have them fish and you go back down and get the rest of them fish. And I did. Man, I caught fish. Now, I hadn't had many of those good times. Not many,
you know,
but a few.
Bill and Debbie used to.
Huh?
You and Bill and Debbie used to catch a lot of fish.
Yeah.
Bill and Debbie.
Yeah.
Now, did you fish out of a boat, any? Did you have a boat or bank fishing?
Well, yeah, we fish in a boat some, but mainly now on a big lake we fish in a boat. Bass fishing, we fish in a boat.
Okay. Did you use artificial lures?
Artificial lures. Okay. Now, for catfishing, you use stink bait.
Yeah.
Bait we use ourselves. We make ourselves. Out of ruined cheese and blood and whatnot.
Did you ever get into any of the early tournaments? Well, you know, when Rayburn...
No,
first started,
no.
Boy. Really
I don't fish
off.
Tournaments.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's about what I had. I see we're over an hour and a half. So that's about as, like I said before, you can't get a person's life into an interview. But that's a good, I think, overall coverage. And so I appreciate it, Reverend Strong.
Did I put in there about when I first came to Dieball, the old commissary? I don't think
no,
I did.
No. Go ahead. All right, we got a little bit more time. What did you want to say?
The commissary was over here called Southern Pine Lumber Company.
And that was shut down by the time you got here, wasn't it?
No, sir. No, sir. When I first preached revival here, it was wide open. They used wooden tokens for money.
Not in 54, though, were they?
In
51.
Oh, you mean when you put with the revival?
Yeah, when I was in revival, 51.
Yeah, because it closed down about 54, I believe, somewhere in there.
Yeah, closed down.
But I think they had long outlawed.
Yeah, they started using that building for offices and what have you then. But before then, that commissary used wooden tokens. You bought your... your clothes, your food, the caskets, drugstore, barbershop,
fiddle strings,
harness for the mules.
Yeah.
And fiddle string, anything you bought, anything there, that was the community store.
It was the super Walmart of its day.
Super Walmart of its day. That's right. They had
go to the post office and the bank and the barbershop and the doctor's office.
Yes, sir.
Were there too.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So they had stuff on that Super Walmart doesn't even have. Walmart can't get banks.
That's right.
They're trying to.
That's right.
But you remember it from 51, huh?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, see, a lot of that's still going on in 54 when I came here. It had been some, but not a whole lot.
Now, the village was being built about that time, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
You
see, if
that?
I came here, the company began to tear these old buildings down and build new ones after I came here. These new additions.
Right.
LBJ and...
Right.
And
Walter Allen, I think, was the first one.
Yeah.
The project you're talking about, the government housing.
Yeah.
All right, well, I sure appreciate it.